Right, this is Mary Rees recording a Telling Tales interview with Neville Gardner on the 28th of September 2015. Neville, can you tell me about the first time that you came to Halsey Manor and what you were doing then?
Well, I can't remember the exact first time, but I've looked in my diary and I've got a note in there on the 24th of November 1967. That there was a musicians' weekend with, run, I think by Nan, I've got Nan there, so I think that would be Nan Fleming Williams, who actually did a number of musicians' weekend over a few years.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, and how old would you have been about then? Oh,
yes. Oh, I can't
teens,
do sums.
Teens, 20s?
I don't know. 24, 25,
yeah,
something
right,
like that.
Yeah. Young man. Mm. What was your interest in music then?
That was playing the violin.
Mm-hmm.
Because I used to go and play with Nan Fleming Williams in Cecil Sharp House on a Thursday night for the Beginners Dance Club, and we used to have a big band there as well, about 15 people in it or something.
Lovely. So you came to several weekends after that, similarly?
Yeah. The next date I've got in my diary was 1977.
Ooh, 10-year gap.
Well, I don't know. This is not necessarily a 10-year gap, but,
no, sure.
But there was 20th of August to the 26th of August. So I think that was a week's summer holiday or something like it looked like it, anyway.
Yeah.
I think it was Saturday to Saturday.
Well, what was Halsey like then in those days? You came.
Probably the nearest thing is probably almost like the youth hostels, where you had to participate in looking after yourself.
Oh, I see.
So, washing up, for instance, everybody would muck in and dry do some of the washing up and dry as well. There was always somebody there in command of us, if you like, but we'd have
sorting out the chores.
Yes, and people used to do all sorts of things.
Yeah.
For instance, the tables in the long room had to be moved in order to move space. So people always did that, and they also cleared the tables, and they put the crockery out, and all, that's not allowed to do now with health and safety.
Yeah,
but people survived.
Yeah.
So that was one of the things that we used to do. I can remember up on there used to be a tennis court up on the top there with loads of wiring around it to stop the balls going down the hill.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to have dances up there.
Really? Outside?
Outside. And there's a place called the Kopf now, which is a bar. And next to it, there was a barbecue. You can just about see the remains of it. It was a stone-built one. And they used to have barbecues up there. So it was like a barbecue and dance and all together up there. So I can remember that.
Did these things go on during the night? Or?
I think it was sort of early evening. It would get darker later on, sort of thing, but they used to have a band up there and live
it's
musicians,
lovely.
Of course, because
yeah.
There's no electricity there. I'm trying to think what else. I can certainly remember that going up there.
Mm-hmm. So things have changed quite a lot.
Yeah, I was here I've got a couple more dates in my diary, which was 1980. 24th of December to 31st of December, and 1981, 24th to 28th of December.
Wow.
Both of them were over the Christmas period.
Mm.
And in fact, there is a photograph, I think, in the archive, the photographic archive, showing all the people that were there at that Christmas, and I can identify myself just about. I certainly look a bit younger. Well, it's 35 years ago, that was.
Yeah. Golly.
And quite a lot of the people I can identify as no longer with us. They're dead.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I used to come regularly to musicians' weekends from time to time, but not necessarily every year, but because it's quite a long way. It's 170 odd miles from where I lived, so
sure.
It's not round the corner.
But now you come regularly, and
well,
what's your role
these days? 2005, I was appointed as the company secretary for Halsey-Mann, and I did that for 4.5 years. So during that period, I was coming down virtually every month.
Really?
Once a month, about, yes. So that was almost a full-time job at the time.
Yeah,
I had all sorts of little problems. Like, one of the first things was planning. There was, because they had to put in a toilet for disabled people, they decided that there was a space in the gentleman's toilet at the back, on the back corridor. So they were going to, it was a very large rectangular building, so they said, okay, we'll put a corridor up the side and put a disabled toilet at the front, which is easily accessible from the corridor. And then the gents can go around the back, and it's still big enough.
Mm-hmm.
And the planning authorities passed it, and then they put a proviso on, providing the door to the corridor went back on. Now, because the disabled door has to be a lot wider in order to get somebody in a wheelchair in it, it swung through an arc which went across where the outside door fitted. So if the door was put back, you could not use the disabled toilet. So we appealed. Now, that appeal had to go right up to the Deputy Prime Minister's office, who then looked at it, and then they sent an inspector down, looked at it and said, oh, this is no question. The door itself is of no consequence. Mm. It's a modern door, 1920s or 30s something.
Yeah.
It doesn't do anything. Case dismissed. So the door is no longer there now. So, but that is the sort of thing that used to happen with the planning authorities. Would not let us do anything.
Yeah. And it all takes such a long time.
Another thing which I can tell you about was when the boiler eventually decided to give up the ghost, which is down in the cellar.
Mm-hmm.
We tried to get permission to put another boiler in there. No, it wasn't possible because the chimney had to be lined and the chimney wasn't big enough. So we then inspected every single chimney in the building. And there was not one that would actually fit the bill. So we then asked them, well, can we put an outside chimney up? Like we have at the where the laundry is. Oh, no, you're not allowed to do that. So eventually we said, well, can we put the new boilers up in the roof? Well, I don't know about that. Well, I'm not sure. It's a fire hazard and all. So we got the fire officer in, checked. And said, well, providing you put insulation right around the room, yes, you can do that. Right, then we had a chimney. Well, we suggested, because in the roof way there was a double, I don't know what you would call that. There was a valley in between the two roofs. We put the chimney in the valley, and it can't be seen from down below. Oh, they said, no. Well, it might be seen from someone on top of the hill. So you can't put it up straight. You've got to put it up straight and then at right angles. And also paint it black in case it reflects in the sun.
Goodness.
That took about 3 years to do.
Yeah.
That just gives you an idea of the sort of things.
It's so destroying, isn't it?
It takes hours to do and is expensive as well, because every time you're having to do a new plant. So that gives you an idea of a couple of the sort of things which Halsey has to fight against in order to survive.
Yeah.
And they have to put in things because of regulations, then they're not allowed. It goes on anyway. So that's an idea of that. I've also been, since I was teaching violin making in my local education authority. I'm a university lecturer, you see, was my profession, if you like.
Yeah.
And I went to evening class to learn about violin making. And then I took over the class after a time, after, I don't know, about 10 years or something, and then it got handed to me. And so I've been actually teaching violin making for about 17 years now, I think. Now, of that, I started violin making in Holze back in 2006. Because I could see that the local education authorities were cutting back any courses which were not got a computer attached to them. So you had to have a computer attached, otherwise it didn't count. So all craft courses gradually, and now there are about three left in the country, three or four, that's all, violin making classes.
Really?
So it was the start. I saw this 10 years ago.
Yeah.
In those days, there were probably about eight or nine, I would think, something like, a lot more, and they've gradually been chopping them. Because I think the... so that gave an opportunity for Holze to provide something which was a practice and supported their music...
Absolutely.
In the folk music,
yeah.
To carry on.
And traditional craft making.
Exactly, yeah.
It ticks all the boxes.
And according to the Memorandum of Art Association, it was perfectly in order to make instruments which were then used in demonstrating folk music, something. So it fitted into the charitable objects of the society.
So the people that come to learn your violin making, do they come from all over the country or internationally?
Yeah. Well, I've got somebody coming from Edinburgh, so, and I had someone coming from a bit further north than that, and he stopped coming, but he did. I had somebody coming from Switzerland for a couple of times, so it varies. You sometimes get people, and we've got a few local people as well.
Would you say that... There are fewer and fewer all the time, and so you can spread that knowledge and that craft.
Well, I think that's probably what's happening over the country as a whole. There will be fewer and fewer people who know the complications involved. It takes about 250 hours to make a violin, and I've also supervised a couple of cellos, and they take 750 hours to make a cello.
Gosh.
So one of my students made a cello. It took her 10 years to make that.
Yeah.
And she's decided she wants to make another one. She's making two violins at the moment. She wants to make another one now. Anyway.
it's fascinating. And also to think that people are coming from...
Well, this year, this current... in September, that I'm starting this afternoon, will be the 20th... programme at Holze Manor run. It's amazing.
Yes.
I don't know where the time's gone.
Yeah, but it must be fulfilling, or you wouldn't still be doing it. It's such a lovely venue too.
Well, this particular room is very good because it has lots of light, and it's you need light a lot when you're doing violins, because you're working to tolerances of 0.1 of a millimetre.
Mm.
And we use light to actually see where little grooves are.
Yeah.
So it's very, very useful, this. Mm. I don't think there's another room in the place that's as good as this.
Yeah.
Because we get light from... you've got one, two, three, four windows, you see. And it all helps. And very good lighting up above as well.
Mm.
So that's a lot...
So do you do violin making just in London, or do you do other venues?
I've been on other courses. Yeah. I went to courses in Loughborough and Cambridge, you know, sort of weeks courses to learn things. So had other people give me an input. yes. So I don't do it by myself. We have Corrie Shriver also teaches and She was trained in the Welsh School of Violin Making, and she's got she had a shop in Bath for a number of years, violin making shop, so she's got a lot of practical experience, and I've got a lot of theoretical experience, so between the two of us we can answer virtually all questions. Yeah.
So are there differences then in the different, like the Welsh making?
Well, that's no longer in existence now, that stopped because they were going to... They wanted to increase the number of students.
Oh,
and it doesn't work because you cannot teach a craft from 20 students. It's impossible. I mean, at Halsey we have a maximum of 10 students for two tutors, so that gives you a 5-to-1 ratio. Yeah. And you can do that, and they get good attention. They're not hanging about waiting to get, because other your evening class you can have 16 people, one student, one tutor, and they never get to you in that evening. So it can be very frustrating, I think.
So are these popular courses, would you say? Because
I usually get between 8 to 10 people here.
Yeah. That's great.
And we've been going for.
And you do annually?
20 years.
Biennial?
Well, last year I started an extra week. We were doing it twice a year, two weekends. Then last September we had a midweek one, which is some of the students said, can we have more time, please? So we said, okay, I'll try and see if we can get one. Last year we had Monday to Friday, and I had 10 students there. So we're running it again this year, and we've got 9 students this year booked in. And there should have been another one, but she went took into hospital, and this sort of thing happens.
Yeah,
it can do. Mm. So I think it's reasonably.
So what are your feelings about Halsey? You've obviously been involved in the running of it as well as being a tutor.
Well, it is a charity, it doesn't actually cover its costs. As far as I once worked out for a number of years, it needed something like $20,000 a year from outside sources in order to survive as an entity, because the costs of running it are enormous.
But as a resource for food.
But it's unique. It's absolutely unique. There is nothing else in the country like it. It's the only residential centre dedicated to folk music, folk song, any of the traditions and things like that.
Yeah.
And it's a resource. So as people anywhere in the country can actually come and actually use the facilities. And there isn't anywhere else. The only other places in slightly like this is in Cecil Sharp House, which is the headquarters of Ings Folk Dance Somerset. They've got a very good library there. So that's another resource. But the two, to some extent, they're complementary. Sometimes they overlap, but there isn't anywhere else.
No, it's
and if there's a fire in one of those places, it's gone.
Yeah. God forbid.
Well, I'm just saying, but that can happen. So it is good to have at least two reasonable libraries which have got records of what has happened.
Mm. Some of your fond memories, then. Have you got anything particular that sticks out as a Halsey?
Memories. I can remember playing for one of the children's days, playing the violin, and they had about 500 children dancing on the lawn there, sort of thing. And this was one thing, and I joined in the band for that for some reason.
Lovely.
A couple of times I've done that. I think
it's one of the nice things I think about the involvement of children. So
well,
it keeps those,
it's absolutely
those
essential
songs.
Because without the children, we'll say children, anybody up to child up to the age of 50, if you like, is because without those new people coming in, it will just die and wither away, and it'll vanish, and that would be very very sad.
Yeah,
it's been going for over 50 years now.
Yeah, but I think it's enriching to anybody that gets to know something about the traditional songs and music.
But it has its problems, I think, with recruiting staff, because it is in an isolated part of the world, and that gives it its benefit. It's actually, you come here, we're still in England.
Yeah.
You don't get lots of planes going over. You can't hear the main road, although it's only 300 yards away. You're actually in a rural situation, which is quite rare nowadays in England, because we're getting so congested with people. And that's its benefit.
Yeah, we're very lucky.
And you walk out the back door and you're onto an area of outstanding beauty sort of thing on the Quantocks. It's got a lot of benefits to it.
Yes, it is. It's a lovely venue.
It deserves supporting. But as I say, staff is a problem because it is an isolated place.
Yeah.
And they have a lot of competition from Minehead with Butlins, who take staff to, they pay a bit more probably, and it's easy to get there, the transport.
This is true. rather than the legs.
Yeah.
Well, that's been really interesting. I've learnt some things that I hadn't heard from before. About the barbecue and the dancing outside and everything.
I mean, this was an interesting book I picked up, well, I had in my house, which was saying the managers were David and Iris Ewell, W-H-E-W-E-L-L. I don't know when that was, but it says that they were happy to have a minimum booking of 15 people, which I suspect would not cover the costs nowadays.
No,
you need about 35, I think, you know, sort of to cover costs. So that's a long time ago, and it was... they said a maximum accommodation for 42, and I think the accommodation is now up to 62, something of that, maybe 60 or 62, yeah. Something like that. So there's obviously been changes in the way that the rooms have been organised. Mm. Certainly, when I first came here, there were no ensuite facilities at all, and now I think about 60% of the rooms have got ensuite facilities, so there has been a move towards modern requirements.
Yeah, I suppose it's inevitable.
But they're limited to what they can do because of the fact that it's a grade 2 star listed building. Therefore, you cannot do anything inside without planning permission. And I've already explained some of the problems with planning.
Yeah.
You know, they wanted to put a door up. No, you can't change the door. You can face it with something, but you can't put a new door in. I mean, that's the detail which goes into the planning.
Stuck between the devil and the deep blue sea in many cases. You have to improve, but it's a struggle to do so.
But, you know, things are still surviving and just about covering costs with people leaving legacies.
Neville, it would be lovely to hear one of your favourite tunes that you play on the violin. Would that be all right? Can we record a song? Thank you very much. Thank you.